stick with the winners. And the way that was described to me is not somebody that always looks good on the outside and pretends and knows all the lines and all that. It's somebody that lives the program. And I've been going to the Rock for quite some time now, and Joe is there often enough. And every time I see Joe, he's radiating, you know, but yet kind of guy that's willing to get honest and let you know what's really going on. So I think we're in for a treat, and I know you didn't come to listen to me, so I give you Joe.
Okay. Thanks for the kind words, Mike. It's thrilling to be here. I'm going to borrow something from one of my spiritual mentors. I'd like to take another moment of silence, if you don't mind. It kind of helps me with a little bit of the apprehension and nervousness, and I think it puts us all in the right place. And one of my sponsees, he said, if you want God to be real in your life, you got to treat him like he's real. So I kind of use this, when I heard it, as another chance to invite God to be present here tonight. And you can do whatever you want with this moment of silence. Usually I suggest you say a prayer for the speaker. Amen. Thank you for doing that with me. My name is Joe Krogan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Joe.
And I'm honored to be here. And if I see anybody start fanning, you're in trouble, because it's hot in here. And first, I've got to ask a question, because we really clean up well. Are there any alcoholics in this room? Good, because I'm one. And I am an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, or as described in the big book, as a real alcoholic. And I love being at these things. This is a great, great privilege to be here. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. This is my beloved program, and I love it. And there's a lot of winners in this room. People that come to these things are usually people that kind of step out of themselves. And Mike is our coffee maker for 400 Guys in the Woods. And my home group now is the Monday night New Smyrna Beach men's group. And I'm the coffee maker there, because that's one of the best jobs I've ever found in Alcoholics Anonymous. But as I've stayed around, there's a few other jobs, and we'll get into that as we talk. I had to step out a minute ago because it was a little warm in here, and I walked out the door, and Mike knows a little bit of my history, so he goes, last time he said he was going to be right back, he went on a three-dayer. And so he sent one of his sponsees to follow me. And I'm going to try and be coherent tonight. I found out, my wife and I were talking the other day, and I found out that I have mild to moderate case of Tourette syndrome. We were reading an article, and it said in this article that if you break out in song for no reason, you might have, that's a symptom of Tourette syndrome. And if you use, in the verses, body parts, which I tend to do, especially when I'm singing with my kids. So I'll try and be coherent. Anyway, thank you for inviting me here and asking me to be here. This is a privilege. Thank you to Susan, and thank you, Mike, for being our host, and Arlene, his lovely wife. And my lovely wife is here, Tammy. You'll get a chance to meet her over the weekend. She is one of us. And I have a sponsor. And he has a sponsor, and I sponsor guys. I believe in the program. I believe in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think the steps do for us the same thing they did for Mount Rushmore. They change us. They turn something that's hard and cold into something beautiful and magnificent. And that's what's happened in my life. And I'm here. It talks about it on page 29. It says that each of us tell in our own words, in our own version, how we established a relationship with God. And I think that's what the program is. And it's a great title for your program, Celebrate the Miracle, because this is a miracle. And every one of you, you don't know who you're sitting next to, but I hope you get a chance to talk to him and meet him this weekend. Because in the short time I've been here, I sit with people And when I start to hear their stories, I know we're next to miracles. Every one of us has a tremendous story of recovery. And it's thrilling. I got a chance to have a little dinner with another friend of mine from the Atlanta Men's Workshop, which is that men's workshop that we talk about. And I thought I knew a lot of the people in Atlanta. My wife's family's from Atlanta, and my mother-in-law lives about a mile away. So if she comes in, everybody get into these closets. Because I'm not telling my story to my mother-in-law. No. Or you're going to get a real watered-down version. You know, our book talks about moderate drinkers, hard drinkers, and real alcoholics. And I didn't know that. And our rooms are filled with people that are that may not be an alcoholic of my type. It talks about, if you ever read in our big book, when it talks about hard drinkers, it says that they had difficulty quitting. They may quit if certain tragedies occur in their life, change of a job, threat of divorce or illness or certain things like that. They may even need treatment, it says. They may need to be hospitalized to quit. And that sounds and looks like us, a lot of us. But there's a difference for a real alcoholic. And I didn't know what that was for a long time. I didn't know I was one. I never tried to quit. I just tried to get more. And then I thought that was my problem, lack of. I just always thought that was my problem. Lack of money, lack of booze, lack of everything, you know. So when I grew up and I had that terrible sense, that sense of lack that we talk about in these rooms. And I think I intuitively knew there was something wrong with me, like I've heard so many people talk about, but we don't know what it is, and we're so afraid to ask because it seems it's kind of invisible. It's that, is there something wrong? We find out later when we come here, it's something wrong spiritually. We have a spiritual sickness, and that's really what it is. I've tried to analyze it and categorize it over the years. I remember when I first found out what an inferiority complex was, and I thought, oh, that's me. I've got that. You know, ADD, oh, I've got that too. You know, I had them all. My wife calls me untreated poster child for untreated ADD. And we have two little boys. They're 9-year-old twins that are with us. We have more than that, but those are the ones that are still at home. And they're down the street, so we have built-in babysitters. They're twins, and they're so different. One of them is like some of the people that are in this room, like Arlene. We were talking before the meeting. Some of you that are members of Al-Anon or normal people or with alcoholics, I always wonder how they can have this built-in sense. Call each other when we're talking at a meeting. So we like to get the phone to ring. Ah, you didn't turn it off. But the other son is just totally self-absorbed. Now, I love him madly. Believe me, I love him madly, but he is totally self-absorbed. Now, it's not that unattractive in a 9-year-old, but it gets real unattractive in a 20-year-old. Or a 40-year-old. And that's what happened to me. My sobriety date is September 12th, 1990. I never really knew Alcoholics Anonymous before that date. I think I heard the word one time. I know it left my lips one time. I remember when my girlfriend was threatening to leave me right at the very end. I mean, it was close to the very end of my drinking, and she was threatening to leave me, and at this point, I just couldn't be alone, the terror of being alone, because I knew I had come to a place I'd never wanted to be to, and I blurted out to her, "I'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous." Now, where the heck did that come from? And luckily, it blew over, you know. Because I wouldn't have known where to find you. I wouldn't have known what you were. I didn't know what you were. But I never met anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. I met one guy in my entire life that had been in a treatment center. And I was in a bar one day on about a 4-day binge, sitting in a bar. I think my pants were wet because I couldn't go to the bathroom anymore. And this guy was sitting at the bar moaning and groaning. He was like the last hostage I had taken with me on this binge. We were out, and we were, and he was like, "Oh, you know, I just got out of a treatment center 2 weeks ago," and I looked at him, and he was crying, and he was up for 3 days too. And I said, "It's taken me over $1,000 to get here. I don't want to hear your sob story right now." But I didn't grow up to be an alcoholic. I had that feeling that I didn't fit in, and I was compensating my whole life. I was an actor. The book talks about it. We're an actor. And I was always pretending to be something. I remember talking like people that I didn't, you know, I would develop these accents, not foreign accents, but, you know, like I would be, you know, like I was a mobster. I remember my mobster period, you know. Don't worry about nothing. Start me a tab, you know. And I would have, they sounded like I was talking a foreign language, but I was always pretending. But then it didn't matter. If I was hanging out with sophisticated people once in a while, I could talk and use real words, you know. And so I was always, but I was always hoping that I never met them all together. Because, especially my nighttime people, please don't see my daytime people. My God. And as far back as I can remember, It was instinctive in me. I remember, I can't remember what grade it was, but I had this little girl moved next door. We were probably in about seventh or eighth grade. I had a terrible crush on her, fell madly in love with her. She was a beautiful redhead. The whole summer, we had a great summer during summer vacation. Went back to school in the fall, and right away, this was the girl that everybody in class chose to have cooties. You remember cooties? She was the girl. And do you know what? I was just like them. I went from having a crush on her to her being the one with cooties. And I was the ringleader. I could talk louder than they could. I could yell and be more angry, more mean. And I didn't know there was anything wrong with that. I didn't know that I changed like that. That I was such a... I think our book talks about how we were victims of other people's opinions, you know, and we just were prisoner to that our whole life. And I remember going to dances in high school. For everybody would be so excited, they'd walk into a dance. For me, it was like walking into enemy territory. There was that fear, that defense that would come up. And the only thing that ever solved that problem, well, there were things that solved it. I remember lying helped for a lot of years. My mom used to remind me of that. But I remember lying was good. I could lie. And I became a real victim of my own lies at a very early age, like most alcoholics are. But when I couldn't believe in the lies anymore, that's where the booze came in. And I remember the first time I got drunk. I was the guy I always wanted to be. You know that feeling. If you're an alcoholic of our type, you know that wonderful, wonderful feeling. All the pieces fit together. You're right here. You're zapped into the present. There's no future, there's no past, and everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be. At that high school dance, I remember I was went from being terrified to being in the middle of the dance floor, with dancing, waving my shirt around up in the air, with five girls dancing with me, and I was a skinny, gawky kid, but I wasn't that night. And I would have done, and I didn't know how much I loved that feeling. I didn't even realize that all the pieces connected. Went on a few years, and I didn't grow up to be an alcoholic. I went to a private, all-male private high school. I even went to an all-male Catholic college for my first year in college. I went to four different colleges in 4 years and never got past being a freshman. I stopped going when my parents stopped paying. And and I remember the last college I went to was in Miami. I grew up in a place called Niagara Falls, and I went down to Miami. I love Miami. It's like a frontier town. And when I got to Miami, it was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. And I said, okay, I'm going to buckle down. I'm really going to try in school now. And I remember I made the dean's list the first semester. And then I rested on my laurels. And I got thrown out the second semester. I won a scholarship. My grades were so good. And then I flunked out the second semester. I never went back to school. And I devoted myself full time to partying. So from that time on, I was about 19 years old. I devoted my 20 years old. I devoted all my time to partying. I thought it was, let's do what's fun, and I went out. If I had a job, it was usually a job I could, kind of a menial job that I could go, and really my life revolved around getting the paycheck. Let's get the paycheck this weekend. We're going to party. I hear people talk about binge drinking, you know. I really was a binge drinker. It was just at the end, my binges lasted, the in-between was about 6 or 7 seconds in between those binges. And I kind of zipped through my 20s, and then reality kind of set in a little bit. You know, you get to be 30 years old. I remember my 30th birthday, and all my friends that I'd known had now had real jobs. They had kids. They had bought homes. They had cars. I never owned a car that didn't cost $200. And it's true. I was the would find them anywhere. And they would have real jobs, real families. And I was starting to have that feeling. You ever have that feeling? God, I wish I could just be a normal guy. Wish I could just be a normal guy. And I couldn't. I couldn't figure it out. I hated those guys. I hated the guys that could go to work all week long, get paid on Friday, and show up on Monday and pay their bills, because I couldn't figure out how to do it. I went through this. I needed to settle down and get something real in my life and get a profession. So I had an opportunity, and I got a bar on South Beach. I opened up a bar on South Beach. And, why are you laughing? What else would I do? I remember this bar. This was a great bar. It was called Joey's on the Ocean, and it was a disco, and it was right on the ocean. It had a tiki bar that was open at 9 o'clock. The tiki bar would open 9 o'clock in the morning till 9 at night. Then the disco would open at 11 at night till God. And this was when the early days of Miami Vice. So this was my Don Johnson period. You know, pastels and the white linens, you know. And I remember one Friday they threw me in jail. I was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and I had parking tickets or driving an unlicensed vehicle, and they caught up with me, and they threw me in jail on a Saturday night, and it's the drunk tank on Miami Beach, and it's 1,000 degrees in the middle of the summer, and I'm in my white linen coat with a pink shirt and, you know, linen pants, and I stepping over the drunks in the jail, and the one drunk looks up and they go, "What'd they arrest you for, being overdressed?" And I'll never forget that. I just wanted a corner to crawl in. You know, when you've been doing it for 2-3 days, you just want to sleep. So anyway, you can kind of guess if an alcoholic owns a bar, what's going to happen. And throwing money, it was a really busy bar. It got to be infamous in Miami, on Miami Beach. And it was a real infamous place. It was real busy. But throwing money at a bad money manager is not the answer. It doesn't matter. You can throw all you want. And that's what happened. I drank that bar into the ground, but it really did progress my alcoholism. And Bill W. talks about it in his story at the end there. He talks about, you know, drinking, taking sedatives with the alcohol and having to take that to calm the jitters. Well, I took other substances, so that's just a fact. But the alcohol enabled me to do that. I'm truly an alcoholic. But I thank God for them, because they sped up my demise, and they really did. So what happened was, after that bar collapsed, things got really bad. I was living in a hotel room on Miami Beach and didn't have a job. I was almost unemployable at that point. And I started to realize I might have a problem, but I didn't know what to do about it because I didn't know you people. I didn't know there was anything to do about it. I couldn't figure out why my life was so unmanageable. I knew that, but I couldn't figure it out. Because I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol or drugs. I didn't. I really thought my only problem, like I said, was not enough of them. That's what I thought my problem was. What happened was I decided I'm going to quit. And it was one of the few times in my life I said, I'm going to turn my life around. And this is when I started on that cycle of, that's it. I'm done. I'm quitting. I'm going to straighten out. I'm going to get a real job. And, well, I had good intentions, but my grandmother died and left me an inheritance. And that was a bad time to quit. It was a bad time to quit. I had a lot of money, and for a short time. The money went away. I went on a binge to end all binges. And, it was really tough. I ended up meeting a girl, and on this binge, we were kind of similar souls, if you understand what I mean. Well, we were running out of money, and she got pregnant. Now, this is a part of my story I'm not proud of, and I don't feel this way now, but I want to share it with you because I have to. I know there's people in this room that have done the same thing, and I need to tell you what alcohol did in my life, because I need to tell you what AA did in my life. And the alcohol took me to a terrible place. That little boy was born. We had just enough money to get out of Miami. I said, that's it. We got to get out of Miami. You know Miami. And I said, it's a terrible place. This place is evil. I got to get out of here. We got to move to a place where things are totally different. I'm going to be a dad, and I'm going to straighten out my life. We moved to West Palm Beach, Florida. And now, what's a guy like me that's never had a real job in his life do? I'm 35 years old, and I go out and get a newspaper. I figure that's a good place to start. I look in the newspaper. I see this thing that says, no experience necessary. I said, perfect. I'm qualified for that. I have no experience at anything. So I go down and apply for the job. Now, this is the mid-80s. Those of you that were around in the mid-80s know when you applied for a job back then, they would give you a drug test. They would give you a polygraph, and they used to run your credit. So they sent me for a urine test, and they sent me to get a polygraph for the interviews, and they ran my credit. And then I came back the next day and had an interview with the manager, and he's looking at the papers. He's going, holy cow. He said, you lie, you do drugs, and you owe everybody in the world money. You're perfect. When can you start? And I started selling cars that day. Now, I started selling Hyundais, and I don't know why, but I really took to it. Perhaps it was my earlier experience with lying. And anyway, this guy liked me, and I liked him because we hit it off in the interview, as you know, obviously. Now, I'm making a genuine attempt to straighten out my life because I'm going to have a son. I'm going to have a boy, and I know I'm going to have a child. And as crazy as it sounds, I always wanted a child, but it was probably some unfulfilled need that I thought I had. But I really did want to have a child. But I hit it off big in this job. I remember my first month, I was salesman of the month. I sold 24 Hyundais. Anybody got a Hyundai, I owe you an amends. The warranty isn't 100 years. Okay? But what happened was is at the end of the month, you know, they give you a commission, right? You get your commission check, and they had a meeting, and there were 18 guys, sharks. These guys were sharks. I'd never sold anything in my life, and they have a room there, and they put us in the room, and they say, okay, and they handed out the commission checks. I got a $7,500 commission check my first month. They called me up, and they gave me my commission check. I went, holy cow, why didn't I get legitimate before? And then they said, and the salesman of the month, and he hit every bonus there was, and they said, Joe Krogan, come on up, and they gave me another $4,500 check. $12,000. First month, selling cars. Now, when I walked out of that, there's a story in the book like this. I walked out and I said, you know, I got to go show a car. I'll be back after lunch. 16 days later. The crazy part is this. It's not that I disappeared for 16 days. On the 16th day, I put a shirt and tie on and showed up for work. Think about it. That's the craziness. And I walked into the job like nothing had happened. I made up some crazy story because, you know, and the crazier the stories, if you're an alcoholic of my type, you know you got to go for the real crazy stories. You're defying them to call you a liar to your face. It's got to be so absurd. And, right, Jeff? You know. And anyway, they yelled at me for about 5 minutes and said, all right, get out there and sell a car. I thought, I love this job. I love this job. Anyway, I started making a few dollars to keep my head above water and try to control my drinking. And I remember the day my son was born. I went to the hospital. And I fell madly in love with that little boy. I held him in my arms. I was at the hospital. He was absolutely beautiful. I made all these promises. I cried that day. I held him in my arms, and I told him, I'm going to be the dad that I always wanted. You and I are going to be friends forever. We're going to tell each other we love each other. We're going to know it. I'm going to coach in Little League, basketball, and baseball. and we're going to be there for each other. And I meant it. And I, like somebody took a light switch and flicked it on in my life. There was something in my life that changed. And I knew instantly he's the first person in my life I would ever lay down in front of a bus for. I don't know how I knew that, but I knew. I knew if he was in the water and there was a shark, I would jump in the water. I'd never felt that way about anybody. But as much as I fell in love with that little boy, I walked out of that hospital room and I didn't show back up for 8 days. I don't even know how they got home. I couldn't be anything that I wanted to be. It was way beyond that point in my life. Alcohol had me. It was a short time after I managed to keep we bought a little house. I managed to maintain a little bit. I got a little bit of credit, bought a car. But you know what happens on self-will? We can't keep the ship afloat. What happened shortly after is they foreclosed on that house. They repossessed the car. And I had to sneak out of that house in the middle of the night in a $200 car that I didn't pay for. And this was about a year and a half later, and I drove down to Fort Lauderdale. I knew a guy who hadn't realized how bad I had gotten and knew me when I was a top salesman. And he said, "Oh, great, we got a job for you. We got a car for you." I get down to Fort Lauderdale, and they give me a car. I go in to talk to the guy. He says, "When can you start?" He gives me keys to a brand new car. Great. I said, "Listen, I'm just going to take care of a little business today. I'll be here first thing tomorrow." They had to tow that car away from my motel room 8 days later. I wouldn't open the door to give them the keys. At this stage in my drinking, I don't open doors. I don't answer phones. I don't get mail. There's tape over the peephole. You know what your life is like. That's what my life had become. And I got a little boy in a crib who's in filthy diapers and there's no food. And I'll tell you what, I could mean it from the bottom of my heart. I could look at you and I could say, "Please, I need $20 to get milk and to get some diapers for my son." And I meant it. And I remember one time I borrowed some money from somebody. You used to have to really reach out, because my motto when I drank was, "If I know you, I owe you." So I used to have to really search for somebody I could borrow money. And when I'd show up in their life, they'd give me $100 just to not to be around anymore. "Hey, remember me? It's Joe." "Oh, my God. What's he want?" Well, anyway, I remember one time I got some money and I went out and bought some groceries and I was going to turn my life around again. This was another of the time I'm going to turn my life around. That morning I woke up just like every other morning, and the worst feeling in the world, if you're an alcoholic of my type, here's the worst feeling in the world. The morning you crack your eyes open after the binge, when there's no more, and you know what you did. And here's the part, and you hate yourself worse than anything in the world. Here's the problem with self-loathing, though. By the time you get to where you hate yourself, everybody else hates you too. And that's where I was at. There was nobody to call. I hated myself, and I looked in that mirror and I cried real tears, and I said, I'm going to turn my life around today. I'm going to go get a real job. I'm going to get some food in here. I'm going to go to work, and I'm going to turn my life around. And about an hour later, I would start doing this. I'd start, "Hell, all the good jobs are taken. Tomorrow morning, I'll get up real early. Today, I'm going to have one beer. Or I'm going to do one line. Or I'm going to do one something to just take this edge away." And the next thing you know, I would be cracking my eyelids open again, going, "Oh, I can't believe I did it again. That's it. I'm stopping. I'm quitting. I'm done." Well, here's the bad news. My girlfriend, my son's mother, was pregnant again. And at this point in our life, I didn't want to bring another child into this world. We gave that child up for adoption. That was my idea. And the reason I did it is not because I didn't want to bring a child into this world, because I found out that the adopted parents would support her. And at this point, I was nothing more than just a hanger-on for what little money she got from the parents, the little allowance that they gave her to take care of the baby we'd spend. That child was born on September 4th, 1990. They went to the hospital, that little girl was born, and I never laid eyes on her. I know where she is today. I've written a letter to the attorneys and made my name public should she ever desire to find out who one of her parents are. And as I told you, my sobriety date was September 12th. Well, September 11th was my 9/11. I remember, and I've heard people talk about hitting bottom, but I never heard anybody talk about hitting bottom like I hit bottom until I realized in Bill's story when he talks about it. When the doctor and his wife are talking and they say, he's going to be dead. It's the Undertaker or we're going to have to lock him up. And Bill said, I heard that, I knew it, and I welcomed it. That's me. Every time I cracked my eyelids open, I was mad I was still alive. I was mad because I really wanted to die. I didn't want to live anymore. And that's what he talks about. I welcomed it. He said, quicksand stretched out in all directions around me. There was no friendly direction. That's how I was. And I really felt that way. I remember that night sitting there. And for me, it was like a reverse spiritual awakening. And I realized what I had become. I saw myself in your eyes for what I really was, without any of my motives or excuses. I got to see myself. It was the most horrific sight I'd ever seen in my life. And he said, alcohol was my master. And he surrendered. He didn't surrender to sobriety. I hear that in rooms, and I couldn't relate to it. I never surrendered to this program. What I surrendered to was to die an alcoholic death. Just like I knew I was going to join the endless procession of sots that went on before me. Remember that in the book? I know exactly what that felt like. I didn't know if it was tomorrow. I didn't know if it was next week. But I already knew what my epitaph was. That's how I was going to die. And I stopped. I said, I got to stop trying to quit. It's the quitting that's killing me. I had a brainstorm. Right? I realized it's the quitting that's killing me. Stop it. Just be what you are. And you know what? That was my last night I ever took a drink. And I wanted to die an alcoholic. There was a knock on the door in this motel room. I was in a Skid Row motel. My brother walked in. And when he walked in, I hadn't seen him in 2 years because I owed him money. But he had found out that we were there and that my girlfriend was pregnant again and now there was no baby. He had showed up there and he walked in and I saw the horror on his face when he looked. And I couldn't even get up. I was sitting there in a drunk stupor in a chair in this motel room. And he looked and he saw my little boy and he said, you need help. And I knew he was right. And there was something that happened. It was a little flicker at the end of a long tunnel. I don't know why, but I remember thinking to myself, you mean there's a way out of this? He said, here's my phone number. If you want to stop, call me. I'll watch your son while you get help. So, that was the last time I ever had a drink. Now, I don't know what happened. I didn't plan on stopping. Talk about a miracle. I surrendered to this disease. The next day, I've made that phone call. He came and got us. Took us into his apartment in Miami. And I thought, now I didn't know about AA. Didn't know anything about it. But I did know about treatment centers. I had heard, you know, in those late night stupors watching TV, there's a couple guy, Eric Clapton and David Crosby and a couple of the musicians, you know, from my day had got sober. And I thought, I could do that. 28-day program, that's what I need. Back in Miami, I need a little sun. I'll get one with a weight room and the Olympic pool. Get back on my feet. That's what I need. I can straighten out. And they don't take guys like me. There's a name. It's called indigent. And I got all the brochures from those places. And I remember we were trying to find a bed for me. And they finally, but before that, somebody called the house. And they were in AA. And they said, does he want to go to a meeting while he's trying to get in to these places? And I said, oh, tell him, no, thank you. I'm going to get treatment. But thank you. It was a nice thought. I really thought I was going to go get treated and be well. I didn't know what they did. They inject you with something. They give you an enema. I don't know what they do. They make you read something. And I really thought I was going to get treated. So finally, I go with my brother. He's got a ride for me to his treatment center. And it's an old, we get there. It's in Little Haiti in Miami. And it's an old abandoned apartment house that they had converted into a treatment center. It was run by the United Way. And we get there and I'm going, wait a minute, man. We're driving down this street and I'm going, I used to buy drugs around the corner. I'm not sure I want to be here. And he'd say, no, no, no. And I got there, and I had my little brown paper bag because that's all I had. And I got out of the car, and I said, I'm not sure I'm this sick. And he was gone. He was there was nobody there. I was on the street corner. So I walk in, and I had an interview with this guy, and he's giving me the old questions, you know, the 20 questions, you know, have you ever stolen for your alcohol? And yeah. Has it ever affected your relationships? Has it ever affected your employment? Yes, I'm getting real depressed because I'm checking yes to everything. And finally, I get a glimmer of, oh, he tells me it's a six-month treatment center. I said, 6 months? You don't understand. I got a little boy. Now I got a little boy, right? I can't stay 6 months. I'm busy. So I'm looking for an out. I've always been looking for the angle, for the loophole. So I get to a question where the answer is no. And I thought, maybe I don't have to stay 6 months. I'm not that sick. And he looks, he says, has alcohol or drugs ever affected your menstrual cycle? That doesn't count for you. I said, no, it hasn't. Anyway, I spent 6 months in this treatment center, but I remember they brought an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in the first night, and there was a guy who walked in, and he was clean, and he had a watch. I remember he had a watch because I thought to myself, if I had that watch, I wouldn't be here. Because I did not want to get sober. I just wanted the trouble to stop. I wanted the felonies to go away. I had accumulated a few of those, and that's really what it was, And I just wanted the trouble. I couldn't figure out still what was wrong with me. And I remember looking at this guy sitting there in clean clothes, and he drove up in a car, and I thought, wonder how would they pay for this gig? You know, I bet I could do that job, you know. And, you know, I think I want that job. How do I get it? And I remember during the course of the meeting, there were 50 of us in this place, and he said, there won't be five of you still here in 6 months. He said, I wish I could give you better news. And that night, I was devastated. It was my 40th birthday, and I was in this treatment center for indigents. And they put me up in a room, and in that room, there was this guy. He just got out of prison for 10 years. And they said, this is your big brother. He was 6'6", weighed 300 pounds. He goes, this is your big brother. His name is Bruce. You do whatever he tells you. I said, Bruce, I didn't bring a nightgown. But they put me in a room with Bruce. And the other guy, there was another guy in our room, and he was dying of AIDS, a little Haitian guy. He was dying of AIDS. He was a street junkie. And I remember just curled up in a fetal position against the wall. And the only thing that gave me any hope was Bruce came out of the bathroom and turned the lights off, but I remember him kneeling down at the side of his bed and praying. And I didn't know what anything was. I didn't know what was going on in my life. And I was so stupid. I represent the dummies in Alcoholics Anonymous. So the dummies that are in this room, I represent you guys. Believe me, I had no clue. Before they let us out of the treatment center, they made us write your life story, right? It's kind of like a fifth step. I really wrote my life story. When I was 5, I had a dog. His name was Spot. You know, and I thought that's what they wanted. I had no clue. They let me out of this treatment center. I was totally unprepared for life. I was unprepared for recovery. I didn't know. I left that treatment center, but I made it 6 months later. They did say one other thing. He said, if you stay till the end, and I'll remember this at the first meeting, he said, if you stay till the end, your life will never be the same. That was the only thing I wanted. More than anything in the world, I did not want to go back to my old life. See, I knew. I knew. The whole time I sat there, this is great and I'm in treatment, but it's only a matter of time. I will screw up. I'm an alcoholic. I'm 100% convinced sooner or later I am going to use and drink again. I know that. I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I got out of that treatment center. I went to the only place I had. Mom, I'm home. Where every good 40-year-old alcoholic goes. She lived in a place called Lady Lake, Florida. It's in the middle of the state. And back in 1990, this was like nobody lived there. Tammy knows there were no stoplights. There was nothing. It was like the redneck capital of the world. I remember, and I'm sitting there and in this on my parents' front porch, and they had helped set up my girlfriend with my son, and they'd set up an apartment, but I didn't feel it was safe. She was still using. I didn't want to go back there. But I remember next door, my first night home, there was a guy watering his lawn next door, and he comes over. He goes, "Hey, my name's Frank." I said, "Hey, Frank." He said, "I hear you had some trouble with alcohol and drugs." I said, "Oh, Mom's been talking." And he says, "You want to go to an AA meeting?" I said, "Well, it's either that or watch 60 Minutes. Let's go." So we went to an AA meeting. He says, "I'll pick you up 7:15. He was out front. 7:15, didn't even beep the horn, just sat there, waited. And I went out, and we went to my first AA meeting in Lady Lake, Florida. There's about 25 people there, and you couldn't put together a whole set of teeth. So that's another thing. If we tell newcomers, if you want what we have, no. The only reason I stayed is because I didn't want what I had. That's the truth. I just didn't want what I had. And I used to sit there and look at these guys and I go, "You're so damn lucky I'm desperate or I wouldn't be here." And I didn't know that's how this thing works. You know, it works so perfectly. Alcoholics Anonymous is so designed for a guy like me. I stayed there. 3 days later, I went and got a job. I found this Cadillac dealership in town. I said, "I'm going to go sell cars and go into this Cadillac dealership." And I go in and I'm waiting for my interview. You know, I couldn't see any of this. Greatest thing that ever happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I have come to believe. And that's kind of like, let me tell you what it's like. It's like holding an acorn, but knowing that's an oak tree. So when you're new in recovery, step two is something you do when you don't believe it, you don't understand it, you don't even commit to it. That's okay. You can't see it, but it happens. I went into this car dealership. I'm waiting for an interview. Finally, the general manager calls me in the back. "Who is it?" "It's the guy who gave me the $12,000 check in West Palm Beach about 4 years earlier." And I told him, "I just got out of a treatment center, and I'm trying to stay sober. I had 6 months sober, and I really need a job. And I won't let you down," you know, the whole thing. And he said, "Well, I'm not going to let you sell Cadillacs, but we got this little Mazda store out back. You go out there." And he gave me a job. And I was happy. And Frank, the next day, 7:15, I'm having dinner with my folks. And I look outside and this little car is out there running again. And I'm thinking, it's that guy Frank. And he's not beeping the horn. He's just sitting outside. And I'm going, I cannot wait this guy. You can't. I didn't know he had a newcomer. He wasn't letting go. And he sat there waiting. So finally I go out and I said, "Frank, I said we would go to an AA meeting. I didn't say we were going to go steady." And so he took me to another meeting. And he took me to a meeting every night for 6 months. I smoked his cigarettes, burned his gas. And Frank became my sponsor. And he's my sponsor to this day. Frank saved my life. You think God doesn't have a sense of humor? Look at that. He's next door. I needed a guy. See, I got a sponsor in New Smyrna Beach, too, because I need some adult supervision. I need somebody like my son Mikey, the one twin I told you about. I need somebody to go, "Don't touch that. Put that down. That's enough. Stop that." So I got to have somebody in my life all the time telling me. See, I know this is a form of insanity. We have a disease that centers in the mind. Frank took me through the steps, started taking me through the steps, and miracles started happening in my life. Those steps, I'll tell you, they're designed. They're designed to peel it off. And I remember we were going through the first three steps, and we're reading those first 60 pages, and, you know, we're getting to step two, and I'm asking him the typical questions. "Well, Frank, you know, Frank," everything he said, he never told me what to do. He wasn't one of those guys. But Frank would get to that point, you know, and he set me free with everything he said. He set me free from my old ideas. You know, our old ideas availed us nothing. I remember telling Frank, "I don't know if I believe in God." You know, we started talking about God. He said, "That's okay. You don't need to believe in God. You just got to start living like you believe in God. You can do that. You've been a phony your whole life." I said, "You're right. I can talk like a minister. Okay, I can do that." He set me free. There was no guilt involved. I wasn't lying or being dishonest for the first time in my life. That's why church didn't work for me. I go to church, but don't get me wrong. For alcoholics of my type, it doesn't work because as soon as we get there, they go, "You got to have faith." Faith? I don't have faith. This program develops faith. It gives us faith. That's what this program... This is for the hopeless, the faithless. So Frank would take me to... We'd talk about that. That was the first thing Frank said to set me free. And I remember I went to work. Now I'm working in this little dealership. And sure enough, there's a guy in there that used to be in West Palm Beach that I used to party with. And this guy's still very active. And his alcoholism and his drug addiction. And we go out. I did something stupid. Remember, you know when you're new, you go, I just want to go play pool. Or I just want to go listen to the music. I represent the dummies. Well, I went with this guy to go listen to the music. We ended up in a bad place about 50 miles. We were in Orlando, about 50 miles away from where we lived, and he's drunk, and I am panicked. You can only drink so many Coca-Colas. And I'm, you know, that edge is coming on me. I'm going, this is the day I knew would happen when I was in treatment. Sooner or later, I'm going to screw up. See, and I got there, and I started having a fight with him. I got to go home. He doesn't understand. It's not his fault. Well, we got into a big fight. I ended up taking a taxi home, and the next day I show up for work. Now, he's at work. I get there 9 o'clock in the morning, and I hear my name paged. Joe Krogan, come to the office. So I go down there, and Tony's sitting behind the desk. He says, I know you go to those AA meetings, don't you? I said, yeah. He said, tell me the truth. Do you talk about me there? Now I know I'm not long for this job, okay? I go, oh my God. So I walk out of that office. I go, oh, that's it. I'm done. Because now, you know, if you're an alcoholic, you don't want to be around a sober guy. I go back and I call Frank. Frank, you won't believe what happened to me. Frank laughs on the other phone. I tell him what happened. He says, oh, this is great. He said, this is great. You were talking about God. This is perfect. I go, what's perfect? He goes, I want you to pray about it tonight. And then call me back tomorrow. Let me know how God works it out. I said, why? Has God got another job? Does he own a car dealership? So I said that same old thing. They're lucky. I'm so desperate. I wouldn't try this stuff. But I tried it. And the next day I showed up for work. This is true. I showed up for work the very next day, and Tony Caparelli is gone. He's disappeared off the face of the earth. He was shot 8 times the night before trying to buy crack. Now, he didn't die. It was a small caliber gun. He was released from the hospital the same day. But he wrecked a company car. We never saw him again. Disappeared out of my life. So I run back to the office and I call Frank. I said, Frank, you won't believe it. God shot him 8 times. That really happened, too. But you know, when you're stupid, you're too stupid to know that this has some connection in your life, that there's something spiritual going on here. You know, Frank continued to work with me. And we continued to do the steps. And about that time, things started to happen. I started to get better in my life, you know, because I was, begrudgingly, I was willing. I was still willing. And I started to make some amends. I started to pay back some money. I got the felonies. I made restitution on those things. In a very short time, and within a year, I got custody of my son. His mother disappeared. We still don't know where she's at today. He's only seen her twice since he was 2 years old. He's now 19. But I got custody of my son. I remember we were doing the third. I remember coming home from a meeting with Frank one day. I go, Frank. And I watch Frank. Frank would be at the end of the meetings, and he would always be talking to the newcomers. I couldn't figure out how he knew who they were. Now I know. Now I know. We stand out. You know, so, but Frank would be talking to the newcomers after the meetings, and I'd go, Frank, I'm your date. Let's go. And, because I was only there doing the deal because I had nowhere else to go. And Frank, you know, and finally one day it dawned on me, and they talk about this program, and it's going to change you. And I remember asking Frank, I said, Frank, when is this going to happen for me? When am I going to start to care about other people? I know they talk about, you know, that guy outside waiting with his car like Frank. You know what that is? It's called unconditional love. They used to talk about it in the rooms a lot. I don't hear it mentioned very much anymore, but that's what that is, unconditional love. That's what we do in these rooms. It's called unconditional love. That's what Frank did for me. I thought he liked me. And I'd say, Frank, when am I going to start to be a nice guy? When is this program going to make me a nice guy like you? He started to laugh. He said, if you wait till you feel like a nice guy before you start acting like one, you'll be dead. I go, really? He set me free again. Frank always talked about getting out of self. That was his favorite thing, get out of self. I think it says that on page 89. It says, when you know, intensive work with another alcoholic, it gets us out of ourselves when all else fails. I forgot, that's the problem, me. I'm the problem. And I still am the problem. So anyway, I ended up doing a fourth. Oh, I meet a girl in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've got a bank account. First time in my life since I was a 12-year-old paper boy, I got a bank account. Now, I haven't paid income tax in 20 years. But I still got a few little skeletons there. But I met my wife Tammy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she had 2 years sober, and I had like a year and a half sober. And we started to go out, fell madly in love. And things are great. My life is great. I'm getting promoted at work. I'm making tremendous money. I'm paying back. I meet Tammy. We go on a great weekend in Miami one time when we finally had been going out for about 6-8 months. And we go away to Miami, and I come back from Miami, and I put my ATM card in. I finally got an ATM card, and I go to get some money out, and it won't give me any money out of my checking account. And I call the bank, and they were closed. I called Frank. I said, Frank, I think somebody stole my identity. He laughed. He said, who would want your identity? So I go to the bank the next day, and they said, you're right. The IRS seized your bank account. Call Frank. He says, oh, isn't this great? Oh, thank God. I said, what do you mean? He said, you'd have never wrote the check. God is doing for you what you can't do for yourself. Now, I don't know about you, but I know he's right. Frank looked at me one day, I'm telling you, and he's the only person in my life ever said this to me without it taking it personal. You know how sensitive we are. He looked at me one day, and with all the love of a father for his son, he put his hand on my shoulder, and tears were almost in his eyes. He said, Joe, you're so full of shit. But I knew he was right, and he loved me regardless. I'd never experienced that in my life. It was okay to be me. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me it's okay to be me. I love you people. I love this room. I love the people I've met in this room. All my heroes are in this room. I walk around with a notepad behind you. I'm the biggest imitator in the world. I want what you have today. I did a fourth and fifth step with Frank. Tammy and I got married, and she had two kids, and I had Joey, my son Joey, and so we had five of us. And we got married. The minister that married us is in my home group. So he did the counseling, you know, the premarital counseling. He said, Joe, you have some serious issues you need. I'm 42 years old. I never had a real relationship in my life. But I thought, I'm sober. 43. I'm sober now. I'm qualified. Because I'm sober, I am qualified now to have a good job, to manage my finances, to be in a relationship, to be a friend, to be a father. I thought I was qualified for all that. I didn't realize. I was just qualified to start learning how to do that. It just began. Now, remember that night I told you about when I asked Frank, when am I going to be a nice guy? 2 days later, I got custody of my son. He said, God's working for you right there. He's going to show you how to love another human being. And that was the beginning. Then he put Tammy in my life. And Tammy and I, and the hardest thing we ever did was get into a relationship. There's an old Billy Joel song. It says, they started the fight when the money got tight. They just didn't count on the pain. If you're an AA, count on the pain. But I thank God for the pain. It saved my life. I've been running from it my whole life, and it was the thing that was going to bring me the biggest miracles in my whole life. Heck, what would have happened to any of us if Bill W's, when he went to Akron on that business deal, what would have happened to any of us if it had succeeded? This program was founded on that. So And see, Frank pointed all this stuff out to me. I mean, Frank really, all he did was say, all I want you to do is let me give you my perception of what those steps mean. And you just arrest yours for a while. Just put your perception down. So anyway, we did a fourth and fifth step. Wonderful. Like our old friend Keith used to say all the time. I talked about the goat and the midget and got it all out with Frank. And I'll never forget that. And I was freed. I was freed for the first time in my life. I told another human being everything there was. There was no dark secrets anymore. Well, I started to manage my life. Here's the problem. I stopped after five. And if you're new, you know, in the program, they have that little story about the three frogs on the log. And I heard this and I said, this is exactly what happened to me. They said, what if one of the frogs makes a decision to jump into the water, how many are left? Three, of course. He just made a decision. That's step three. He said, you don't hear the splash until step seven. And I never did six or seven. I stopped at step five. And what happened was I started to manage my life. I got successful. I got a job offer down in West Palm Beach, Florida. I'm tell my wife and kids, we're going to West Palm. She's like, are you crazy? And I'm going to leave all the guys I know in AA, and I'm going to go down. It's the best job I've ever been offered in my life. I said, let's just go down there. And I finally coerced them all into going, you know, kind of at gunpoint. And it was self-will run riot. I had started to manage my own life again. I took it back. And I had the best job I'd ever had in my life. I couldn't believe 5 years earlier, if they knew where I was, they wouldn't let me around them. I had 200 guys working for me. I'm making more money I ever dreamt about making. Bought the biggest house I'd ever dreamed about buying in my life. Tammy and I are married beyond my wildest dreams. I'm thinking, this is great, but I don't have time for meetings. I'm running two car dealerships. I'm the general manager, and I'm there at 7:30 in the morning, and I'm getting home at 9:30 at night, and my family is flipping out, and I can't understand it, and we're battling every night, battling, and I'm, you look what I've done for you, look what I've done for you, look at this, and I'm off to work 7 days a week, and I ended up being a hero on the job, but within 5 months, she couldn't take it anymore. She divorced me. Threw me out of the big house. I got my little boy in hand, and we're looking for an apartment, and now I'm using credit cards to pay off credit cards. And now my head, I'm so enraged and I want to die. What's happening is, finally, I ended up leaving there. Finally, they found out it affected my job, and they fired me. So now I'm divorced, and I've lost my job. All in a matter of about 8 months total, because I stopped, this program stopped being number one in my life. Well, I remember I wanted a drink. I was so angry. I was so enraged. And I remember I went by this little bar. I used to drive by it. It was on US 1, and it was a bar I was really attracted to. It had a name that I'd always been attracted to. It said Bar. And the parking lot was in the back. You know, and I thought, I can be a big shot in this bar. You know, I know I can go in there and run things for a while. And I drove by this bar like a buzzard circles a catch every day for about 2 weeks. But you know, it's hard to go drink when you got 5 years sober, when you know alcohol will kill you. Because I knew that. I never got over that feeling. I knew it. I just had to get to where the pain was so bad. And I remember one night I left my little boy in the back room sleeping. And I said, that's it. God, you can take this if this is sobriety. I didn't know it wasn't. And I jumped in my car and I drove across town to that bar. And I'm going to drink. And I want to drink more than I want anything in the world. And I don't care. And I know it. And I don't know what's going to happen after that. I get to the bar. I'm a block away and I can see it. And I'm stuck at a red light. And I look over. Another true story. And I look over and there's a broken down van sitting there with its hood up. And I just happen to look and I take a double take and I see the front license plate and it said, have you prayed today? Now, when I remember talking to Frank about prayer, and here's how Frank described prayer. What the hell? Try it. I said, well, anybody that talks about it so irreverently, I can relate to, you know. So, believe it or not, I said the serenity prayer at that light. And I don't know why I said it. I didn't not want to go to the bar. And I went into the, you know, they talk about that strange mental blank spot that precedes the first drink. I had it. But I ended up at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd been to 1 year earlier when I first moved there. And I walked in the back of the room. There were 150 people, and there was a guy at a podium. And he looks out and he says, this is an anniversary night. We're celebrating anniversaries here. Does anybody have an anniversary? And all of a sudden it dawned on me. I had 6 years that night. And I raised my hand like a dummy. And they all clapped. And they said, here's what we do at this meeting. We all come and share for about 5-10 minutes how we stayed sober. And they said, since you're a visitor, we got about 6 or 7 people. You're a visitor. Why don't you start us off? So I remember having to walk up to the front of the room, and I'm going, oh, God, I got to come up with something good now. I got to the front, and I turned around, and I looked at all the faces like I look at your faces. And I saw all the love in the room, and I started to cry. I couldn't stop crying. I said, I don't know how to do this thing. I need help. And there were a bunch of people from the treatment center sitting in the front row, newcomers, so they rushed me off stage. They go, no, that's not, it's not how it is with 6 years sober. They took me in the back room, these two guys. And they said, you know, it's like the old joke. They go, we're going to show you one more time. AA's always got one more time, you know. Unconditional love. And they didn't care. They listened to me bellyache about my divorce and rage and all this other stuff. But they started taking me to the prisons. And they started taking me to the detoxes. And I started sponsoring guys. I remember I needed a job, and I didn't want to go back to the car business. It was such an ego, and I wanted to. The first time in my life I ever made decisions based on spiritual principles. I had been driven to that again out of desperation. You're lucky I'm so damn desperate. I'm going to try it. And that's what I thought. I said, I'm going to be, let's stick with what I got. I got a little boy that I know I'm madly in love with. I'm going to start to be a dad. I'm going to take a job, and I don't care if it pays minimum wage and we have to live in one room. That's going to be a home. We got each other. And he'll eat stir fry every night because that's all I knew how to make. But we got each other, and I says, I'll take a regular job. And I didn't know what I was going to do. And I get a phone call from a friend of mine. He says, hey, listen, I've got this hearing aid practice over here on the West Coast. You'd be, you know, it's 9 to 5 and it's really easy work. It doesn't pay a lot of money. But I thought, God, that's like selling vacuum cleaners. To a good car salesman like me, that's like degrading. Anyway, I went over and I took the job, and I started working in the office, and I ended up moving over there, my little boy and I took him to school every day, started coaching him in football. I started going to meetings noon, 5:30, and that little boy was with me all the time. I sponsored a guy, started sponsoring this guy. He passed away. He died sober, Ernie. I love Ernie. I've seen a lot of guys die in this program, but he kept me sober. Ernie was put in my life. Another guy put in my life by God. I saw him at a meeting one time, and he came up after the meeting, and I heard him share in the meeting, and I go, oh my God, everybody was afraid of this guy. And after the meeting, and he said, would you sponsor me? And he says, I could really relate to what you were saying. I said, sure. How long you been sober? I figured he had like a couple days. He goes, 5 years. I said, oh my God. But he forced me to go through the steps with him. I said, what we need is to go through these steps. And these guys took me through the steps. And they made me promise that I must take others through the steps. By the way, it does say that in the book. That's what our real obligation is. So I encourage you. I've heard people say, well, sponsorship is not my thing. It is our thing. We have recovered and been given the power to help others recover. That's our gift. That's our gift. Every single person in this room, that's your gift. This is the fun up here. The real gift is going to the treatment centers and the detoxes and sponsoring guys and making coffee. Those are the gifts. If I stop doing that, I'm screwed. I'm done. Anyway, Ernie saved my life. And a little while later, Tammy and I we ran into each other. We had been separated, and we both threw ourselves back into this program. And something happened when we went through those steps completely and started to give ourselves to other people. And not because I'm unselfish. Because I found God can work with whatever he's got. He can work with us. So don't worry. We ended up getting back together and dating. And then she got pregnant. We got pregnant. And that was scary at 48 years old. But you know, he blessed us with these two little boys. We have these twins now. And I ended up liking this profession. I ended up opening up some offices and did like 8-9 offices. And I ended up selling my practice a couple years ago. Incredible. I mean, we're for an alcoholic like me. I ended up, here's the greatest thing. And we made, and I did very good financially, but it's only because I paid those income tax. I paid those, all those things I didn't want to pay. I paid off a repossessed car for 10 years sober, $100 a month. That was gone. The car was gone. 1988. Took me 10 years. And here's another thing Frank taught me. I remember when I got the bill, I had moved and they stopped sending me the payments. I thought maybe I paid it off. Well, 2 years later, they send me, I remember I got my first income tax refund back. This big check, like $8,000. I said, damn, holy cow. So we get this big refund back. 2 days later, I get a letter from a bank. It says, you have 7 days to pay off the $2,500 you owe us on that car. And this is 2000. No, it's the year 2000. And this is from 1988. Or we're going to put a lien on your home. And I'm fuming. I am fuming. I go to Frank. I said, Frank, look at this. And I'm trying to negotiate with these people. They don't want to negotiate. They hung up on me. Frank says, listen, why don't we do this? Let's just switch the order. Let's pretend you got the letter first. And then let's pretend the refund check came second. He said, if you didn't take ownership of that money, you'd be happy. This would be a miracle. Let's just switch the order. You know, that's what sponsors do. They see things the way we don't see them. That's what this program does. It changes the way we look at life. So, but here's one of the greatest things that happened to me, besides Tammy and my kids and my family. My wife and I, every day we get a chance, we pray together, even when we don't want to. We were sharing this with a friend of ours, a couple. And just the other day it happened. Do you want to pray together? No, I said. I'm late for work. But of course, we won't walk out of the house. And it's hard, and if you're a couple, it's hard to sit there and be mad at somebody who's asking God to forgive them, or asking God to forgive you for what you've done. So we made a commitment to do that, because it says that in our book, too. I try and take that book literal today. It says we invite our wives and our families into this. My son, Matt, he prayed with me before I came here to speak to y'all. And I had another great thing happen to me. I remember 2 years ago, I got an opportunity to go to Cambodia. You know, and I read something in a book today. I sponsor a guy who's a doctor and a psychiatrist of the mental hospital in Leesburg. And he's a Sunni Muslim. And this is really neat when you get to do your third step on your knees with a guy like this. And we've had tremendous spiritual awakenings together. And it's just been incredible. And he's opening up a sober house. And I was reading him the one page in the book. I can't remember what page it's on, but I was reading it to him today, and it talks about we've been given a job to be a maximum service to our fellows, and this is a gift. And I thought, and it may take us to the most sordid places, and I remembered this, so I wanted to share it with you. I got an opportunity to go on a medical mission trip, and this doctor friend of mine, and he said, yeah, we're going over. And I said, hey, you know what? I've always wanted to give back a little bit. I'll go on a mission trip. Where are you going? Key West? I hope. They said, no, we're going to Cambodia. I said, Cambodia? Anyway, the next thing you know, I was on this trip to Cambodia. And out in the jungles, fitting little kids with hearing aids because they don't have antibiotics, so some of the kids don't have hearing. And I'm in this hut with dirt floors, and I'm fitting kids and giving them the gift of hearing that they've never heard before in their life. An old car salesman, alcoholic, like me. How does that happen? How does my life turn around like this? We got kids that love us, that pray with us every day. You know, I'm so grateful to be here. There's so much more I could tell you. And I know I ran over and I'm sorry, but I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want you to have the most special weekend this weekend. There was a bar in Miami that I used to love. It was an after-hours club, and it was called Sammy's. It didn't have any sign. All it had was a little door. You ring the doorbell, and you slide the door open, and the bouncer would look out. And believe me, this place was, all the limos would be outside. Cops never went in. They weren't allowed. And it had been there forever. People had been killed in there. I mean, but it was the greatest place around. It was my favorite bar in the whole world, but I'm going to tell you why. And I remember going to this bar, and And when I had my bar, I'd go there and bring my little entourage or my posse. So, and we'd go to this place, and they'd open the door and see us. They'd let us in, and you'd come in there on a Saturday night in your disco clothes, and there were no windows. There'd be 300 people in this place. But this is why I liked it. They'd throw you out at about 10, 11 o'clock on Sunday morning, and they would give you a full glass of whatever you drank. And I'd have scotch. Full glass of scotch. And they'd open that door to let you go. And Miami Beach on a Sunday morning, the sun is brilliant. And they'd open that door, and then they'd give you a pair of cardboard sunglasses. And I walk out of this bar one day. This is the truth. I walked out of this bar. I got a cigarette hanging out of my mouth. I got my glass of scotch. I'm in my disco clothes, my Don Johnson clothes. And I'm walking down the street, and I get to my car, and I get in my car, and I got my cardboard sunglasses on, man. And I'm living life. This is great. And next to me pulls up this little car, and in this car there's a family. They're clean. He's in a little, got the drive. The guy's in a nice white shirt, you know, with short sleeves, and he's got a tie on. Looks like he doesn't belong in a shirt and tie, but he's in one, and he's clean. And the same thing, there's two little kids in the back seat, a little boy and a little girl. And I just noticed them, and I don't know why it sticks in my head. She's in a little dress with curls, and he's in, you know, little boys never look good in clothes. You can dress them up, but they look like they don't belong. And they're in this car, and now you know where they're going, right? Sunday morning. And I look over at him, and I think, what a bunch of losers. And they look over at me and they go, hey, Mom, there's the Antichrist. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God, I'm in that car today. Thank you.